This recording is a production of Faith Builders. This presentation was recorded at Teachers Week 2013, held at Faith Builders on August 6 through 9.
I think we will go ahead and get started. First of all, I'd like to give you just a little bit of an introduction here. And before I do that, I'd love to find out who you are. How many of you are teaching for the first time? Oh, wow. Interesting. Middle school, I'm assuming? Okay. I have taught for a fair number of years. I just want you to know that this is intended to be a hands-on workshop. Maybe not literally, but hands-on, in that I want you to feel free to interrupt me at any time. And because I know that if I go on, you might forget the question you had, and maybe answering your question is the most important thing we do today. The other thing is, feel free to offer your suggestions, because I am still learning. As a matter of fact, this past year, I changed my schedule around a bit to accommodate some students with special needs. And I thought, why didn't I do this before? Because it really made for a stronger classroom. To begin with, I should tell you that the first couple years that I taught, if there would have been one, if my board would have come in and said, you may drop any class that you would not like to teach, I would have chosen English. Are you in the same boat? Well, I despise teaching English. And I remember plainly attending public school, and I understood fourth grade. I understood a noun, because nouns, for the most part, are concrete. Verbs, I remember wrestling intensely with what is a verb. And I hope that we can spare our students that same type of grief. And actually, I was working with a very inferior English course the first number of years I taught. And my students were leaving sixth grade and were not effective at even picking out subjects and verbs. And I just felt defeated. I just felt like, you know, we're really not getting very far with this. And I changed courses, and it made English concrete for me, and I love it. And to this day, it is a strong number two as far as what I enjoy teaching. As I mentioned, you're welcome to jump in here anytime, and what I want to do is just go through this, and especially some of you that are teaching for the first time. It's been a while since you've been in the middle grades yourself, and so I'd really like to show you some of the importance of the things that I do, things that have evolved in my classroom, and why I do what I do to help the students succeed with English. Why study English? Well, English is really our means of communication. And if you don't have a good grasp of English, there's a chance that you... Now, really, honestly, you can understand the Bible without knowing that this word is a verb. But if you're going to be an effective communicator, it is important that you it's going to enhance what you write, what you say, by speaking and writing with good grammar. Let's talk, first of all, about grammar. When you are, one of the basic things that we do in my classroom at the beginning of the year is we meet up with finding subjects and verbs. And almost annually, I find some students who will say, well, that's the verb and that's the subject. How did you find it? I just looked. And I have sentence strips that we do a lot of, and we'll just, let's recite the verse. Go ahead. Read it together. So what are we going to do to find the verb? We're going to look for an action verb. That's the easiest one to find. Oh, and the action verb is?
Blue.
And then make sure that your students are asking who blew or what blew. Because if they do that, the answer will almost present itself without too much thought. Take a look at... this sentence. And this one, if they do this, because if you take a student who is not organized and who just p- picks out subjects and verbs, they will tell you that the treetops flew. There's my subject and verb. And they should know that that doesn't make a whole lot of sense. A program that was used in a special ed class in our school, the first part of speech they taught was the preposition. And I think that might not be a bad idea. Because I tell my students, if you get into a complicated sentence, the first thing you do is get rid of the garbage. And the garbage is the prepositional phrases. It's amazing. Take a lengthy sentence, get rid of the prepositional phrases, and you've got your basic core of that sentence left. So here, we need to get above the treetops out of there. And what flew? The bird flew. So make sure that, that they treat it that way. The herd of horses crossed the stream. What is going to be the common error? What are they going to tell you is the subject and the verb? The horses crossed. And it isn't because there's garbage there. Get rid of the garbage. The herd crossed. And there's my subject and verb. When students work with the helping verbs, I've been amazed at how many times I will tell them, well, what kind of verb is this? And they will take a sentence like this, I should help you. And they'll say, well, I is a subject, help is the main verb, and should is a helping verb. Well, that's true, but, you know, and what I like to do to this is to help the students relate to it, because they really should be saying that should help is an action verb. And that is, when your mom got married, she changed her name and she became whatever your dad was. So it's like this is a verb couple. And should, we no longer look at it as a helping verb, but we look at it as part of a verb phrase, whether it's an action verb phrase, a being verb phrase, or a linking verb phrase. Going on, is it an action, a being, or a linking verb? And when I look at this sentence, this one is a very common one also. So I will ask, what's the verb? And what will they say?
Am happy.
Am happy. Right. I will ask you this question, can you happy? No. It's not the verb. And at the time that we're meeting up with this, we don't really talk about what happy is at that point. It's just not the verb. But that's a question that when we, in my classroom, what I like to do is I give the assignments. When they are finished with the assignment, they hand it in at the end of the day. If they're not, it gets put on my table first thing in the morning so that I can grade it before class begins. After having done this for quite a number of years, I don't use a teacher's guide. I think. And I buzz down through there, and it moves pretty rapidly, actually. But at the beginning of the day, when we pass, at the beginning of English class, we pass back these papers, and we talk about the wrong ones. That's our review. And it also helps them understand why they missed something, why it's wrong, and we want to talk about what is wrong, because I think that often that's where real learning takes place. And so when they say, well, I've got number two wrong, well, what's your verb? Am happy? Can you happy? No. Well, it's not the verb. And then the question comes along, well, what kind of verb do we have? Is it an action verb? No, you can't am. Is it a being verb? And this is always difficult for my fifth graders. A being verb merely shows that it be, that it is, its existence. That's what a being verb is. A linking verb will always have a complement linked to the subject. And by the way, this is a linking verb, linking happy to I. And the way I demonstrate is I'll stand in the aisle and give me your hand, give me your hand. I'm the linking verb. I am linking the subject to a complement. And it helps to make it concrete for them. Here is a sentence that right here, and again, if I get rid of the prepositional phrases, I've got of the in the middle and of the circle are no longer in that sentence, and so there I was again. And again is not a noun, so we don't have a predicate nominative. It's not an adjective, because it's telling me when, so it must be an adverb. And so I was is my the basic part of my sentence. And so that is not being linked, it's not action, must be a being verb. In meeting up with nouns, and I should have found one here. I had one earlier. I've got one up here. No, that's not that one. Well, we can use this one. Any time that you meet up with a, an, or the articles, it tells you a noun is coming. And the way I like to introduce it is by telling them, there's a rough place in the road, you know, when we go from here to Dublin, from our school to Dublin, Ohio. And I said, there's a rough place in the road. And when the lights start flashing and the arms come down and the bells start ringing, what does it tell you? And they said, well, a train's coming. And I said, that's right. And when you meet up with a, an, or the, it's going to tell you that a noun is coming. Now, sometimes the arms come down and you wait a while before the train actually gets there. It does not mean that the very next word is going to be a noun, but a noun is coming. It's got to come. So, and here we have in the middle. And they might find that a difficult one to see, but the circle. So it tells you that a noun is coming. Oh, here's the one I was looking for. An angry bear followed a scurrying raccoon into the cave. And so an tells you that we have a noun coming. A tells you we have a noun coming. The tells you we have a noun coming. With the word there is often confused, and I meet up with that when the students are writing sentences. Sentences to show that they've mastered something in English. And the problem comes in giving me the wrong form of there or in misspelling T-H-I-E-R. And I'm trying to show them, I often do this on the board, trying to show them that there, regardless how you spell it, begins with T-H-E. And hopefully this gives them a visual that they can remember, hopefully, that there always begins with T-H-E. And when you meet up with sentences like this, this one, students often want, and this is not a very good sentence for what I'm looking for, but they often want to say that, now this is not a good sentence at all, but an example would be, there was the kite. And what's your verb? Was. What was? There was. And that happens quite often. And even a number of years ago, I would tell them, you know, there can never be a subject. And a number of years ago, one of my students wrote a little poem. She, and this is in relation to underlining subjects and verbs, she wrote down, there is never a subject, there is never a verb. If you don't underline it, you will do superbly. But she wrote down superb, and so I kept it as she wrote it. And this is one that if we have students underlining there as a subject or a verb, we just repeat the poem in class, and it has helped it to stick. Another one is probably the two main marks of punctuation that are abused in the English language are the comma and the apostrophe. And for the comma, one of the rules that I tell the students, and you, I don't think you'll find this in any book, but the rule is when in doubt, leave it out. If you, and I tell the students this, if you cannot give me a rule telling me why you're going to put a comma in there, don't put it in there. There needs to be a rule. You don't just put a rule in there. Actually, one rule is to avoid misreading. And the sentence that I remember that is given in our book is, where she is none of your business, or something of that nature. And between the two is's, you need a comma, just to avoid misreading. But there is a rule for it. The the possessives, we have consumable English books with a paper cover. And what I do is to help them out is just, we open our books to the front cover and we give three little rules. I try to make it as concise as I can. And so the three rules that we give them, and they will, later after I'm done with my English class, they will write this in their book just so that they have a reference point without digging back through old papers. It's right there at their fingertips, and hopefully it'll be embedded before it's the time for the test. Any singular, and I try to make this as brief as I can, all they need to do is add apostrophe S. And then we give them an example. I said, give me an example of a singular noun. So cat. Well, add apostrophe S, and you've got cats. And they write this, the example in their book also. Can you see that back there? Or is my marker shot? The other thing that I do with this one is they at times meet up with needing to identify whether this is a singular, a plural, a singular possessive, or a plural possessive. And what you can always do is cover that apostrophe and anything behind it. And if you cover that, that's singular, so that's singular possessive. The only time that rule will get you into trouble is how many R's are in the word Aurora, which is the plural. There's no possessive here. But that idea, and writing it in the front of their English book, and it's amazing how many times the students will refer to those notes in the front of their book, because by the end of the year, we have the inside of our front cover almost filled up. Compound sentences versus run-ons. And I would be embarrassed to tell you that how long it went before I fully got a good grasp on this one. But especially for you first-year teachers, Becca made it so easy for me. I'm sorry, I wasn't going to tell you what I teach, but they made it concrete for me. And that anytime you have two sentences, and this is what I tell my students, anytime that you have two sentences, they either need to be joined properly, and the proper way is with a comma and a with a mark of punctuation and a conjunction, or else with just a semicolon. But before you label any sentence as a run-on, you need to be able to tell me what the two sentences are. This is a run-on. All we need to make it a good compound sentence is after here putting in a semicolon, or after here putting in a comma and a conjunction. And then it becomes a good compound sentence. It's interesting. Read the newspaper. You will see run-ons. Read books. You will see run-ons. But I'm told that they use a little bit different standard in writing professionally than we do with our students. Sometimes my students meet up with a large sentence, and they need to take this sentence and correct it, capitalization and punctuation. And some of the students really struggle with this. And if we have, let's say, 10 sentences like this, what I will do is I'll tell them, you have approximately, I won't give them an exact number, but you have approximately 75 points in this activity. And by doing that, it gives them an idea whether, you know, if you only have 50 points, you better search again. But what I've also told them is I would not whip through this one and find what I can and go on to the next one. I would exhaust this one before I go on. And that really has seemed to help some students. Let's talk about it. What do we have in this sentence? Go ahead. Well, maybe my question's vague. What do you see in this sentence that needs correction, and why does it need correction? A capital T in Taylor, because that's her name. Why?
Because it's switching from, she started dialogue.
Right.
It needs to be a break.
And I struggled with this one. How do I get my students to do this? So whenever we meet up with a direct quotation, you ask yourself two questions. The first question is, who said it? And the answer is, you're my class today. The answer is, Miss Taylor. Okay, so then I know that I'm going to need to comma there, and I'm going to, and what did she say is the second question. And so, did you read Life on the Mississippi for your book report, Samuel? So all of that gets put inside quotes. And but start basic. And it's interesting what that has done when I've gotten the students. When they actually go settle down and just ask themselves these two questions, it's amazing how much more effective it is. What else do we have? Capital D, because it's the first word of a direct quotation. Capital, why? What? How do you know it's a title of a book? I've never read that. I've never seen that book. What? Because it's a book. It's a book. What else do you read if you do a book report? Yeah. But, you know, this passes right over their heads unless they're thinking about it. So what we really need to do is get them to focus on thinking about it. And so, okay, we've got this, and we have this. What else do we have? Underlined to the title, Life on the Mississippi. It's a noun of direct address. That's right. You're directly speaking to Samuel. Well, then we better capitalize this one too. What else? Does it go here or here? But get them to think. Get them to think, because if they don't, if they're just going to try to coast over it, they're going to miss it. There's going to be way too much they're going to miss. Another item, real and sure, and then also the pair of good and well. I caution them, every time you use the word real or sure, it should be a big red flag. I'm not going to say you shouldn't use the word sure or real, but most of the times when we use sure or real, we really need to be using surely or really. I say, are you sure? There's a correct use of it. But I surely was hungry before lunch. Not I sure was hungry, because I need an adverb to modify that verb. Good and well. A couple little rules, because this is another one that's just abused in the English, in our everyday language. Let's refresh our minds, because some of you are going to be teaching this, and maybe it's been years since you've been taught. You've been taught it, and what are the rules? Don't be afraid of it. Well is always used for your health, and you know. So how are you today? I'm good. I didn't ask how you're behaving. You know, I'm well. Thank you. Well is also that. Then when it's talking about health, it's always an adjective. When it's used in telling how something is done, it's an adverb. Good is always an adjective, and so must always be modifying a noun. Two sentence patterns that I found to be very helpful. She appears tired, and she appeared instantly. And in the first one, we have a linking verb because we have a predicate adjective modifying she. In the second one, we have an adverb modifying the verb, so therefore it must be an adjective. It must be an action verb. These patterns that I have here about a subject linking verb adjective or a subject action verb adverb are really helpful. An example would be, so use the word pretty as a predicate adjective. It's amazing how many times the students want to try to start out with an action verb. And I will even tell them, your verb is the key. So, and these are patterns, or what I have here on your handout is a pattern that I often have on the board. These two patterns. So if they know that they're going to need a predicate adjective, they should know that I'm going to have to get to a linking verb. And that has really been helpful for me. While we are talking about the linking verbs, I'd like to work with a common misconception here on this verb list. This one, technically, is not just state of being verbs. They can be being verbs, they can be helping verbs, and they can be linking verbs. This, and I drew a line here for my students because they have all memorized since about third grade that have, has, had, do, does, did, shall, will, should, would, may, might, must, can, could are the helping verbs. But listen, these can also be action verbs. I have a chart. That's an action verb. This is not have is not helping anything in the sentence I used. It is an action verb. And try as hard as I do, it seems that even by the end of sixth grade, I have a difficult struggle getting some of the students to remember that this, that these six can be action or they can be helping. These can only be helping, unless, of course, you can peaches. So what do my students memorize? Because I guess I'm a pretty firm believer in memorizing. This is a chart that they need to memorize. And actually, it's so nice to teach after a good third and fourth grade teacher because they know this coming into my classroom. So this is one that we don't spend much time at all on. But yes, we have a very good teacher there. In sixth grade, we meet up with the indefinite pronouns. And it's interesting with this one because let's say each. Each can be used as an adjective. It can be used as an indefinite pronoun. As an example would be, each student was present. We have an adjective. Each did his homework. Now we have a pronoun. Because if it's a subject of a sentence, it has to be a noun or a pronoun. And so this is a chart that they need to memorize. The personal pronouns with both the nominative or subjective case. And what's interesting is these will be used as predicate nominatives or they will be used as subjects. These will always be used as direct objects, indirect objects, or objects of prepositions. And if you can keep that straight, you'll know which way to go without doing any guesswork. One of the things my fifth graders run into is when we first run into the personal pronouns is that they are supposed to know when it's a direct object. You use an objective case pronoun. But we haven't studied complements yet. So it has presented a real problem. So what I've told them, and this is another thing they write on the inside of the front cover, and that is that I write down nominative, and behind it I put down S, or after an LV. Because, is that you? Yes, it is. I, because it's a predicate nominative and we need a nominative case pronoun, and that's the one that the students will miss. And I'll say, follow the chart. Don't go by what you've been taught because you've been taught wrong. Is that Sue? Yes, that is she. And if it sounds foreign to you, keep working at it. It'll come. Let me see here. Help me out. Give me an action verb. Does she like him? Yeah. Because we have an action verb, so we need a predicate nominative. I'm sorry, a direct object behind it. So we use an objective case. This chart is a bit confusing because we have our possessive case pronouns, but technically the my, the your, the her, the our, the your, and the their really are not pronouns. They're always used as adjectives. That is my book. Why it is presented in this way, I do not know, but I always need to make sure that the students understand that even though my mind, your, yours, his, her, hers, its, our, ours, your, yours, their, theirs, that some of these do the work of an adjective. They really are not pronouns. The interrogative and demonstrative pronouns, and I right here, the interrogative, well, you know what an interrogative sentence does, it asks a question. Interrogative pronouns always ask a question. Demonstrative, well, if you demonstrate something, you show something. And these all show something. It's this, it's that, it's these, it's those. So they all demonstrate something. And those are handles that I use with my students to help them remember which ones are which. And again, if you are a first-year teacher, I hope you don't have the pitfall that I did, and that thinking that you teach it one day, they'll have it the next. Sorry to tell you this, but they don't. Review those charts, review sentences, review. It's going to be the strength of your teaching. It's going to be making it that you have less frustration in the long run. The third and fourth grade teacher gets them to memorize our program gives them 46 prepositions, and they know those word for word when they come into my classroom. So I deal very little with this, which is a big help to me. That list is another one that we memorize. It's the sometimes action, sometimes linking verb list, because I taste the hamburger, I am performing action, so it's an action verb, but the hamburger tastes good. The hamburger is not performing action, so it's a linking verb in that case. There are 11 of them, and they can be a little tricky, but work them. They will work, and the students will be stronger because of it. A number of years ago, my daughter, she had never taught before, and she had no goals of teaching either, but there was another community that the teacher was going to be out of the country for 1 week, and so she was my daughter's friend, and my daughter agreed to sub for her for a week. And she came home, and she said, "Dad," she said, "these students were trying to pick out adjectives and adverbs, and they were totally lost. Until I found out that they had no idea what the adjective questions were and the adverb questions were, and what they can modify." She said I made them each take out a note card and write on there, and what they wrote down was adjectives modify nouns or pronouns. And the questions are which one, what kind, how many, how much, whose. And for the adverbs, it is how, when, where, how often, to what extent they can modify verbs, adverbs, or verbs, adjectives, or other adverbs. And when she got that on their note cards, they could do the assignment. But that is a really a key. Make sure those students know their adjective and adverb questions, because we'll be working with right here, this one. She appeared instantly. Well, that tells me when. What's a when word? A when word's an adverb. So we know right off that instantly is an adverb, not an adjective, because it answers the question when. And if they can relate that to a question that the word would answer, it will make it easier for them. So what do I do when we begin a new chapter? I say, okay, class, today we're going to begin a chapter on capitalization. What do you know about capitalization? What happens if I start rambling and telling them capitalization rules? They tone me out. What happens when I get them to share with the rest of the class? They get involved. And it brings their focus back to English class. They're trying to be the first one to come up with a rule that they remember. And Yeah, they like to show off a little bit, but that's okay. It gives them a good chance. When I struggled for years with wasting so much time in passing out papers because my students were handing in their work at the end of the day, most of them. I was grading, and the next day it would take so long to pass out papers. This past year I had 4 rows of students in 6th grade, and I just went to the 2 middle rows. And anybody that was in these 2 rows, their paper went on this desk. Anybody in these 2 rows, their paper went on this desk. And the first person sent them across or sent them back. And in a very short time, we can pass out all the papers instead of wasting a lot of time. And again, I'm not trying to push my methods on you, because I've heard teachers say, well, you must spend an awful lot of time grading papers. I do. But again, I about know what sentences we're even going to meet up with on this page after having graded them so often, and so I can grade very rapidly. The other thing is, I always have some students, while others are not going to get done with their day's work before they go home, others always have spare time. And if we have easy assignments, all they do is they raise their red pen. That tells me right off they want to grade, and I will give them easy English to grade. And just a little thought, about 2 years ago, I had so much grading going on that ended up not being accurate. And it's just like, oh, well, so we're going over the papers the next day, and, well, they didn't mark this one wrong and it's wrong, or they marked this one wrong and it's right. And so we'd have to, I purposely had not taken grades at that point. So if you want to grade, after you've graded the paper, just put your initials at the bottom of that activity. You know what? If you make a mistake, there's no punishment. There's no scolding. But I found that when they put their initials at the bottom, they were just a lot more careful with their grading. Somebody was going to know who graded it. But so that's something that I do. When they need to write letters as an exercise, I just take a piece of notebook paper like they're going to work on, and I use a red pen and a pencil, and I show them how to line up the inside address with the closing and the signature, and try to do everything just like this. And that paper is on the table for the whole day. Now you should know exactly which lines to skip, where to put your things. You've got a concrete pattern. I need you to follow it. And this is not only a good thing to do in letter writing, but it's a good way for them to learn to follow a pattern and to pattern their work after what is expected of them. Diagramming. When I went to public school, I had a teacher fresh out of college, and she said, I didn't even know what diagramming was. All my days in school, I did not diagram a sentence. Her idea was, if the only reason to diagram is to figure out what part of speech a word is, and if you know what it is, what's the value of diagramming? So diagramming was not done. I will say this. I think that a lot of students find out It takes them through a thought process when they actually do diagram and they figure out what a word is that they otherwise would not figure out. And having had so much sloppy diagramming, I told my students I want them to use a straight edge. And so here it makes it difficult for them because their ruler covers lines they've already drawn. That's a piece of plexiglass. And if they use this on their paper, they can see any other line they've drawn. Works quite well. So I just make a number of these, and they're around the classroom. They can pick them up whenever they need to diagram and utilize that. Probably one of the biggest, most helpful hints that I've ever received in my years as a teacher is to teach And this is the way it was presented to me the first time. Teach in consumable chunks. A little crude statement there, but teach in consumable chunks. I used to go to, let's have fifth grade English class, and so we teach the whole English lesson for that day. And maybe in the course of it, they've got 2.5 pages to do. They are not sure, by the time I'm done, they don't quite recall what we did on the first part of the activity. Okay, what I do now is I'll move to this side of the class and say, let's have fifth grade English class, and so we are turning to such and such a page. We are getting new material. We're looking at example sentences. We're getting the concept. Once we've done that, I want you to work on the first activity. If it's going to take them 5 minutes, I'll move to sixth grade and work with English there. If it's going to take them a minute, I'll say, work on that. As soon as someone's done, let me know. And so what they'll do is, as soon as they're done, they'll raise their hand. Everybody stops. But what if I'm not done? Well, we can't just wait. But you'll have time later to finish this. The other thing that I suggest that they do is that in our book, here is, I'm not sure what he calls it, a practice A. Here are some instructions and here's the work. As soon as I assign it, I tell them, circle it. That way they know it's been assigned. Okay, now, Susie over here, she was done with practice A, and we're going to move on to the next, and I'm not done with this one yet. How do I know later that I need to finish it? Well, because it looks just like this. As soon as I'm done with it, do that. And they will know that I'm done with that activity. I'm totally done with that one. And some students will take to that quite readily, some will not. But the ones that do that always know right in a moment whether they, and the other thing is, and especially the first week or two of school, okay, you're ready to hand in your English? Question, have you reread your instructions to make sure you have done everything that you are to do? Because it's so easy, they'll give them 3 items to do in this activity. Don't hand it in until you've reread the instructions just to make sure that you've done everything that you've been told to do. Another thing that we do is we have, and right here would be a very typical type of thing. We have a couple words that are italicized there. We need to decide, are the italicized words nouns, verbs, adjectives, adverbs, or pronouns? And I found out that if I give my students, 12 of these sentences and tell them, do them, we have way too many wrong. So for something like this, all right, we're going to do the first two. And I might read, wow. I see even forgot my quotation marks. Okay. Do the first two, and then we'll grade. And as soon as you're done, pick up your red pen. That way that I know that you are done, and we can move on to grading. And when I think I see everybody's red pen, is there anyone not ready to grade? Okay, let's grade. And the first one is, and we'll do that, and it's been very effective. Another thing that I've done a lot of is, okay, get started on this one. I'm going to come around the room, and I'll just walk down the room and grade 3 of yours, 3 of yours, 3 of yours. And, oh, you're not done with number 2? That's fine, because I will circle any number that I graded. And it gives them instant feedback. Am I doing it right, or am I going to mess up the whole thing? And I think if you can do that, you're going to create confident students. When I take grades, and again, this one, I showed this to another teacher in our school, and she was like, oh, I would never do this. I've found that when I want to take grades, it's very time consuming for the class. I've found it wastes their time. So what I'll do is, after we've done 3-4 pages, in an afternoon, I will collect papers. They tear the papers out. I've got a sheet like this, which tells me that on pages 2, 3, and 4, it goes together.
for one grade, they're 41 points. And I do everybody's grades that way. Page 5 and 7A, you go together for 43 points. And when I've taken grades on those, I cross that off here. This stays in my grade book until the chapter's done. And when they are, when I'm all done with that paper, the paper goes in the back of the room on a desk, and in the morning before the tardy bell, any papers that are back there are papers that need to get handed out. If they get an English paper back at the beginning of the day before the tardy bell, they know it goes in their folder, and they need to keep it there for future reference. But that's something that I like to do because it doesn't waste their time. And again, I'm not saying you should, but so it is. Require good spelling habits on their daily work. That one has been one thing that I think strengthens when you are consistent with that, and it's, and again, it would really make a difference what age group you're teaching. But, and I've read pros and cons because I have a spelling vocab workshop in the near future, but one comment that I read is students are more likely to use larger, more colorful words if they don't have to spell them correctly. Oh, that might be. But what are they going to do in the real world? Because after all, we are preparing our students for the real world. And so I require correct spelling. You might say, what do you do if they don't know how to spell a word? I'll help them find it. But I will not, at fifth and sixth grade, I will not tell them how to spell the word. You get a dictionary, you try it. If you can't find it, by all means, keep your dictionary right there. I will come back and help you find it. But I need effort on your part. It's not my spelling. Let's talk about some, and again, anytime that you have a question, feel free to interrupt me. I'm fine with that. Talking about writing assignments, English sentences are so important for them to write. My curriculum has a lot of daily work that often has sentences to include. Punctuation counts. Why? We don't just pray on Sunday. they need to put their punctuation in on a daily basis. Writing topic sentences. This is always a big one for the fifth graders. Well, on our social studies and science tests, it's amazing how many times they have to write a paragraph. Well, sixth grade learned last year about writing topic sentences. And so I require a topic sentence of them. Fifth graders, I don't until we have studied it in English class. But the first topic sentences I get are, here are three reasons a frog is not a toad. And I ask them, do you think you would read that, something like that, in your science book? No. You know. Well, so what would be a good topic sentence? Somebody want to pop one off? Don't be afraid. It could even be stated as a question. How is a frog different from a toad? That's a good topic sentence. It draws me to the topic, and it will be easy for my paragraph to be unified under that topic sentence. With creative writing, make sure that you emphasize the fun. And if you don't have any fun topics, dig a little deeper. There are a variety of things we do, and one of the things that I thought about just since I'm here, get them to teach them what a metaphor is or what a simile is, and just have them write some metaphors in sentence structure. It will develop the color in their creative writing. Another thing that I do is when we're going to have creative writing tomorrow, today I'm going to give you four topics to choose from so that by tomorrow when we get together to write, you will have had time to digest. You will know which one you're going to write. You don't actually start writing, but you will know which one you're going to write. You will have an idea how you're going to develop this topic. So you don't have to spend 15 minutes deciding what you're going to write about, because that's always the most difficult part. What are your sources for ideas? Any thoughts there? Well, I have something here that I'd be willing to share with you if you're interested. And that is something that happened here a couple years ago in Howard Bean's workshop. or work session, I should say. But what he did on this work session of creative writing is we grouped up, brainstormed about five people per group, as I recall, and we came up with, he would say, now let's think about this, and we came up with about five topics. And every group submitted the topics to Howard on a daily basis. And by the end, the last day, he came up, and there are 175 topics that we came up with. One that I pulled off of here recently was the day our town had no sugar. Oh, anybody can write about that. And that was a fun one. And there are a lot of good ones on here, really. Some that I didn't find would be very practical. Oh, wow, an eye-opener. If I were the teacher. I found some really lenient students in my classroom, but I found some really rigid ones too. tongue twisters. And one thing I don't like to do, honestly, I hate grading creative writing. I don't tell my students that, but I really dislike it. I do not assign a letter or number grade for them. It's a check, check plus or check minus. If there's poor grammar in it, I try to mark that. If there's misspellings, I have them do that. And something that I did just about 2 years ago, I came up with a creative writing checklist. The first creative writing they get, I give them this checklist, and they're to keep it for the year. Just a number of items here. Is every group of words a complete thought? Did you use proper punctuation at the end of each sentence? Are your words spelled correctly? Do you have an interesting title? Did you add variety to your sentence structure? Did you indent the first sentence? Do you have a good topic sentence? Does your paragraph have unity? And have you proofread, preferably aloud? And proofreading is done carefully, reading exactly what it says, not what you think it says. Last year, I even did this. I told them, okay, whoever you switch papers with to grade in class, I want you to switch your creative writings. And I want you to proofread each other's creative writings. Well, they liked that. They liked reading someone else's creative writing. And then they got to give feedback. Oh, I think you ought to change this. This punctuation's wrong. This word's misspelled. Before I ever got the papers. And I got much better work, but it was also a good way for them to interact. And just a better set of papers overall. Get them to write some poetry. The easiest one I've found to work with is haiku. It's very easy to write haiku, no rhyme involved, and they say, that's not poetry. It's only three lines, it's always about nature. The most common pattern is five syllables, seven syllables, five syllables, and I often give them, illustrate the picture, illustrate one of your poems. And it's interesting, the ones who don't care to write will find, will have a good time drawing their picture. So give them that. Something that's on here is a croaker, where there's always a pun in a croaker. How many of you are familiar with the croakers? Okay. The pun is always in the verb. So let's see if I can whip one out. Oh, wow. It eludes me. I'll think about it as I go on. A couple ideas if you're trying to teach students how to write is a book that was recommended to me, and I'm sorry I forgot to get this to Matthew for the resource list, but On Creative Writing is another one that was recommended, and they do have a couple copies of that in the bookstore. I like to read the students' creative writing to the class after they've handed the papers in. They don't know whose it is. But if it's read out loud, sometimes they see it better than if I have the student try to read it out loud to the class. One of the things that the sixth graders do annually for English class is we do a demonstration. They will, one creative writing time, they need to do something that they want to demonstrate to the class and write it. And I tell them that when you're done, I should be able to take your creative writing and go through the steps. You've explained it well enough that I could duplicate it. Later, you will demonstrate it to the class. And we always have things as simple as frying an egg to making a sandwich to, I'm sorry, one I didn't let go was how to make microwave popcorn. I said no. One boy brought in a dump truck tire and took the tire off the rim. One boy took us back and showed us how to fish. He baited the hook, he cast in, and wouldn't you know, he caught a fish. That was a neighboring pond. They're supposed to be able to do this demonstration in 5 minutes or less. And that's always a highlight for them. Book reports, they do, I have them doing oral book reports, and I have here just a handout to give to them before when they're reading the book. Turn it over and take notes. I tell them, you know, I would not take any notes on things I don't need to take notes on, because we don't want you referring to the note card. You only get one note card, so you don't load up three note cards and spend all your time watching your notes. You're to be watching, you're to be looking to class. And one of the things that they dislike the most about this is you are required to present it to a person at home. We get a better quality book report when you do that. I have a short form book report, and this gives the information they need for that, and I have a long form book report. I don't like what Abeka has done in the past, write four sentences about the main character. You know what I get? Joe was tall. Joe had blonde hair. You know, four sentences? No. So what I did a number of years ago is I took a good book report, not the top one, but a good one, and I counted the words. We now have a 75-word character sketch. We have a 100-word plot. And if I give them the number of words, I get a better quality on the book report itself. In beginning in fifth grade, our students do a research paper, and this is a big task. We spend a month on this research paper. I am looking for certain items in content, but the main thing I look for is form. Again, I did not like everything that I was meeting up with, so I typed up my own handouts. And we spend some time going over these. In seventh and eighth grade, they do their front covers with a computer. But in seventh grade, they have keyboarding skills that they take, and so they know how to do this front cover. Otherwise, it becomes an older brother, sister, mom, and dad. Or horrors, my mom and dad know nothing about the computer, and I'm the oldest child in the class, or in my family, you know, and so I have a front cover that's not nearly as good as anybody else's. Well, in my classroom, we still do them by tracing. I have them generate their letters on the computer, and usually they can do that. If they can't, we'll help them. We'll get an older student to help them in the afternoon. And they trace those on the front cover, and they draw the picture. If they'd like to, they may do the free front cover freehand. But I've given them every step. And someone told me, "You're a control freak." Well, maybe I am. But when it's time for them to read for a book report or for a research paper or something like that, what I do is they've got their book. Every day I go around the room and I find out what page you're on. And I've just, you know, you may call me a control freak, and that's okay. But it's a little like the old adage that says, because I've gotten burned by students not doing their homework. So you burn me once, shame on you. You burn me twice, shame on me for not getting control of it. So they know that, you know, I'm going to be checking every day to find out. The other thing I do is they bring up their note cards to me every day. And they bring up all their note cards. I just read over them. I don't do any grading. It's when a student has, like, you know, half their note cards are one-liners, they're never going to come up with a 600-word body for that. So I tell them, you need to go back and develop this more. You know, what can you tell me happened? What else happened here? Or I'll take them back to their book. Where'd you find this? We find the page. What more can you tell me about this story? We help them develop it. I put a check mark on the paper, on the note card. The next day, I have all their note cards. I only read the new ones. It takes time, but then, horrors, years ago, I had a student who wrote his, I was not checking over their notes. He wrote the body of the paper, and it was just horrible. And I don't meet up with that now because we catch it before they get to that point. I also give them this. This is one that rarely anybody does about Harriet Beecher Stowe, but this one of my students did this. She drew the front cover freehand. And so I've taken it, and here I even did this so they can determine which line it's on, which coincides with the instructions in here. And the outline, I used her outline. I would do something a little differently than what she did, but I merely used hers. And so the student has a good grasp of what I'm really wanting. Our seventh, and I need to close in just a moment. Our seventh and eighth grade teacher was frustrated when she was having her students do the research paper, because I've told my students, I want you to write your note cards in complete sentences. And to avoid plagiarism, they're reading the book. I tell them, close your book and write the note card. That way, we avoid the copying to a large degree. The reason I want them to write it in complete sentences is because when they're done, they count the number of words on that card and write it on the back. And when you think when you think you're halfway done reading, come up and get my calculator. Add them up and see if you're anywhere near where you should be. And they're always glad for that break. But that way they're not in the dark, because I've already had students who, they were finished reading and, they only have 400 words. Or someone else who's done reading and they have 1,000 words. So that's something I've done. The seventh and eighth grade teacher said, I really don't want them writing complete sentences. And we decided, it's okay. It's okay for the fifth and sixth graders to do one thing. It's okay for the seventh and eighth graders. Now, you no longer write complete sentences. Write phrases. Write as little as you can on that note card and still know what the note is about. Well, when they type up the rough draft, if they have 200 words less than they need, it's very easy for them to go and add on keyboarding, but it's not that way if you're writing longhand. I have a checklist that students get as they finish a step. It gets initialed. Something that I would like to do for you, these are not necessarily for you to use to copy. I mean, I don't mind if you copy them, but they're not intended for that. What I'm doing, I'll make these available to you if you'd like to take them, and if you want to copy them, be my guest. But if you'd like to pattern after it and do your own, that would be what I would recommend. I have here, if we can, a place for you to put your name, and if you want research paper information, then I will run copies of that for you. If you want book report, I'll run that information. A checklist page, I'll run that. That's for the creative writing checklist, or for the composition ideas, we can run those. And Matthew said, sure, fine, it's fine to run those copies, and we will just put them out here on this table outside, and you can pick them up tomorrow. But I didn't want to make copies for everybody, because there's a good chance not everybody will utilize them, and it's just a waste of paper. So if you'd like that, and actually you don't even really need to write your name, if you'll just put a check mark in any column that you want, it will give me an idea how many copies to make. Any comments? Any questions? I'm going to tell you, go home. Get these students going with a good foundation, because it's amazing how successful they will feel if they know what they're doing. And God bless you.
For more free resources that support teaching and learning, visit thedocforlearning.org.